You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today we're at Puy-Marie, Cantal.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am with Le Doyen de la Salle de la Presse.
Well, I'm
Francois Thomaso.
Yeah, I'm less and less a doyen of the Salle de Presse because we don't go very often to the press room. But yeah, le doyen
and Lionel Burney.
Thanks, Richard. Hello. Good evening.
But you just jumped in there, Francois, when I said le doyen de la Salle de la Presse. Mm-hmm. You jumped in, assuming it was you. I might have been talking about Lionel.
Incredible laughter there from Francois. There was no chance that would be me. No. Well, I think this is my 18th full tour, Richard. So, I mean,
you're heading towards doyen status.
I've got a doyen haircut. It's all fallen out.
Oh, well, where are we, Lionel? I don't need to say that because we're in this more or less the same spot as last night.
We're just a little bit along from where we were last night in the centre of Clermont-Ferrand, which is really busy, bustling town. Friday evening, everyone's finishing work. People are having an early dinner or a post-work drink before heading home, and it's a lovely balmy evening, quite warm, isn't it?
I continue to be quite impressed by Clermont-Ferrand, especially, we didn't mention last night, but the trams, very modern trams. Any city with trams is enhanced by those trams, in my view.
Well, trams, yeah, they're all the rage in France. It's funny because
not the Arkea Samsic tram of last year.
No, it's true. Many cities have. It's funny because they had trams in the 1930s, and they got rid of them to favor cars and buses and stuff. And now trams are back in the force.
Dr. Beeching got rid of them all, and then
le médecin.
You know what? It's a funny fact, and I have to say it because we often go in the Pyrenees in places like Aix-les-Thermes, and you know, all these valleys we go across, between the mountain passes, the Tourmalet and all that. There are trams there in the 1920s, 1930s, going from town to town. So it was much more modern than we think now.
Very civilized. Well, it's lovely. We only had to venture about half an hour up the road for the start today. Then we came back here, and the stage starts right here tomorrow. I took a little bike ride up to the foothills of the Puy de Dôme, and where the race will go tomorrow. A very tough start tomorrow, climbing straight out of Clermont-Ferrand on a kind of strange stage tomorrow. Definitely a transition stage tomorrow. But what we saw today was a bit of a cracker. A lot of people were talking about this stage as being one of the most interesting and difficult, and one that would proved to be a GC battle, which it did, and more than confirming who's going well, it kind of almost eliminated a couple of people as well, didn't it? But what happened, Lionel? What's the tale of the attack?
Well, stage 13 from Châtel-Guyon to Puy-Marie, up and down all day, 7 categorised climbs, and today we had another first-time Tour de France stage winner, and as you say, a shake-up in the GC, which suggests that for the moment at least, the two Slovenians, Primoz Roglic and Tadej Pogacar, are the strongest two of the GC riders. It was a really aggressive start. I mean, if you watched all day, as I think we more or less did watch the whole of the stage from start to finish, the first hour and a half and the last hour were absolutely riveting. There were loads of attacks at the start. Clearly, the composition of the break would set the tone for the whole day. Really important who got into that and who wasn't allowed into that. It took several attacks before a group of 5 got properly clear by the top of that first category climb, the Col de César. Remy Cavagna, the local boy, and Julian Alaphilippe of De Koenig Quickstep
Remy
were in
Cavagna,
there.
Nickname?
Remy Cavagna, Remy Lasagna?
No. TGV of Clermont-Ferrand, because they don't have a TGV in Clermont-Ferrand, you know, the fast train, but they have Remy Cavagna.
Well, he was in there with Julian Alaphilippe. Simon Geschke of CCC, one of our audio diarists, of course, was in there.
We had 2 riders in the break.
We got 2 riders in the break today. We did well, didn't we?
We did a little bit of pretend BSing at lunch, didn't we?
Yeah, if you could just get into the break and then not do too much work, guys, that would be great.
Throttle back a bit, please, Sivakov.
Dan Martin of Israel Startup Nation was in there, as was Marc Soler of Movistar. And then there was a big counter-attack move behind, which, as you say, had Sivakov of Ineos in there. Leonard Kamner and Max Schachman of Bora Hansgrohe. More of them in a minute. Hugh Carthy, Nielsen Paulus and Danny Martinez of EF Pro Cycling. And then the French had Warren Barguil, Pierre Rolland and Romain Sicard. A special mention to Valentin Madouas, who spent a long, long time riding across what was becoming a bigger and bigger gap from the bunch to the break. He made it and then spent a while out in front on his own as well. And then at the finish got fourth. I mean, a real super ride by Madouas today. There was a period where Paulus of EF was off the front by his own. Then Schachman caught him. Marc Soler tried to counter, but I couldn't quite get a handle on his tactics today. He certainly couldn't keep up with Danny Martinez when the Colombian rider rode across and up to the front of the race. He's the recent winner of the Critérium du Dauphiné, of course. On the final climb, Schachman was out in front on his own, and then it was Martinez riding across the gap, really set about that job in a very methodical, classy way, especially having Leonard Kamner marking him all the way up, knowing that he was dragging one of Schachman's teammates across the gap. And then at the finish, he found himself the EF meat in a Bora Hansgrohe sandwich. I'm not sure whether that sounds particularly appetising. They all came together with 1.6 kilometres to go, which sounds like it was close to the finish, but actually it was about another 5 minutes of racing. It was a really steep finish. Kamner, who'd been dragged up to that group, he may as well have signalled his intention to attack with a fireworks display. It was that obvious. The next couple of moves by Kamner were slightly less telegraphed, and in fact his decision to open the sprint early initially looked like it might catch Martinez by surprise, but the Colombian, who looked great on that final climb, you have to say, came round him to win the stage. So over the line it was EF first, Bora Hansgrohe second and third, and as I say, Madouas in fourth. The race for the GC behind was the Pog and Rog show. Roglic and Pogacar eased clear. They distanced Egan Bernal, and then sort of there was a bit of a sort out behind. So if you look at the GC riders, Roglic crossed the line 6 minutes and five behind the stage winner, with Pogacar just in his wheel. Richie Port, who's been riding extremely well, was 13 seconds back with Mikel Landa. Then came Miguel Angel Lopez, Egan Bernal, the defending champion, who's lost 38 seconds to Roglic and Pogacar. Uran was with him, then Adam Yates, then Quintana, Dumoulin a little bit further back. A bad day for the French, unfortunately, Francois. Romain Bardet crashed, tore all his jersey and shorts and finished 2 minutes 30 down on the Roglic group. Guillaume Martin, who'd been lying third overall this morning, of course, lost even more time. Not entirely sure what had happened to him. As you say, tomorrow, Richard, a bit of a transitional stage, but a sort out on the GC, and Primoz Roglic is tightening his grip on the yellow jersey.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns, and scaling new height with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Hi, my name is Mike Mooney. I run Hub Velo in Hackney, London. Hub Velo started about 6.5 years ago in a very small shop in Hackney. The original shop was just a very small, it was actually a nail bar, one of Hackney's finest nail bars. And the shop was very small, as I say, and we just had a bunch of bikes in there and a small workshop. And then business just really started increasing almost week on week. We got busier and busier. 4 years ago, we bought the shop next door, which is twice the size. And we had opened a cafe, and we now have a big space, a showroom, with a cafe for seating. And it was at that point we decided to start our cycling club. So we, probably much like any other small companies, have cash flow is always an issue, especially in the cycling world, because it's very seasonal. And in the winter months, business just drops off. Like, it gets the end of November and it's just like falling off a commercial cliff. Everything stops. It's very difficult to kind of maintain the business. We have the same staff, we have the same space, we have the same outgoings. So it's always very difficult to do that. So to maintain the business with obviously a decreased amount of income. And then I found out about iWalker. I found them online. I'd read a couple of reviews. And they had everything that I didn't have from the bank. And I had someone that I could talk to. They understood our business. They were young. They were keen. They really wanted to help. It felt like the perfect partnership. It's just been great. I mean, we've got our first chunk of cash. We don't have an enormous amount of money with Iwoka. We don't really need an enormous amount of money. It's just to tide us over through that, as I say, that difficult period in the winter. And the relationship was, I actually have a relationship with Iwoka. Someone I can talk to, I know them, I've been to see them. They ride bikes, they're young, they're dynamic. They're all the things that we didn't have before that we wanted. And that relationship has continued, and that's been really helpful for us.
Thank you very much to Iwoka, our title sponsor, whose support helps us be here covering the Tour de France as we do every year, as we've done every year since 2013, haven't we? And we're very grateful to Iwoka. If you run a small business and want to find out a little bit more about what Iwoka can do to help you, go to iwoka.co.uk. As you said last night, Lionel, they've got very good reviews on Trustpilot, Iwoka, and one of the benefits that customers speak of is that you speak to a real person when you make an application to Iwoka. Now, well, today we had two sort of stories, the stage and the GC, and both very interesting, and it was a very strong group that formed. As you said, Lionel, we watched the opening skirmishes, and it was clear that Julian Alaphilippe, well, it was clear that Remy Cavagna, the local boy, wanted to be in that group, but also that Julian Alaphilippe was keen to be in it and also to make it quite a selection pretty early on. And he was very aggressive early in the stage, faded again at the end, as he's done a couple of times when the stage one kind of drifts away from him. He kind of throws out the anchor, doesn't he, a bit, Julian Alaphilippe?
Well, as Lionel said, you know, in his Tale of the Etape, the French, I mean, if the GC cards have been reshuffled a bit today, the French cards keep being reshuffled in this Tour de France. We lost
slightly, know, dropped on the floor some of the cards.
Yeah,
and
absolutely, like a castle, you know, card castle or something that kind of crumbled down. But yeah, we saw, well, Julien Alaphilippe obviously doesn't have the kick and the kind of form he had last year, so every time he tries, he's not too far, but he's obviously not, like they say, you know, sometimes in other sports, in the zone, you know, where he was last year. And it's the case, obviously, for all the French guys. We had, you know, great hopes in Guillaume Martin, who was doing well so far, being in the provisional podium, and he failed badly today. At the end of the race, he said he didn't know what was wrong, actually. Maybe he crashed 2 days ago. It's very difficult to tell. I mean, all these guys, we saw Quintana losing time today and he crashed, Bardet losing time and he crashed, Danny Martinez, you know, who won the stage and was not the rider, you know, the contender we expected to. The impact of crashes, you know, whether used as diplomatic excuses or having a real effect on riders is difficult to tell. But from what we saw since the start of the tour, crashes obviously have a huge influence on the performances of the riders. So Guillaume Martin obviously hampered by that. And the last climb, which was real murder, let's face it. I mean, you know, all the riders finished with, I mean, we saw Egan Bernal losing time, but, you know, staying on his bike, you know, bent on the guidon, looking in a bad way. I mean, it was a very, very, very tough old school Tour de France stage. And in that last game, we saw Thibaut Pinot lose ground, we saw Romain Bardet, who crashed, lose ground, we saw Guillaume Martin, and well, from the French side, you know, it was kind of a disaster. But in the same time, you've always got guys you don't expect. Pierre Roland has been in the top 10, I think even the top 5 in the last two stages, so obviously in good shape. You mentioned Valentin Madouas, who is a Thibaut Pinot you know, teammate who finished fourth. So there is now room. I mean, now that the GC situation gets a little bit clearer, there's room for stage wins, and we're going to see probably more interesting action coming from all over the place from the guys who don't stand a chance in the GC. Last little remark, you know, we're playing down these guys, you know, Bardet, Pinot, all the guys who crash, Uran or thing, you know, favorites we think are not doing that well. But the worst off of all these guys, Thibaut Pinot, you know, we thought was, he's actually 24th in a GC, which is not. Which is not a bad result, and at the end of the day, even all these guys who lost lots of time through crashes and, you know, being not the kind of guys we're expecting them to be, might end up in the top 20 or the top 15.
24th, you might as well still be a niece, Francois.
Bent over the guidon. It's a rare example of Francois using a French word there instead of an English one. But let's talk about the stage first. We'll talk about the GC a bit later on. You know, there were some teams in that break with multiple members in it, and I think Simon Geschke, audio diarist, has mentioned already, we'll if we don't hear from him in this episode, we'll hear from him in the next Kilometre Zero with the audio diarist. But, you know, he talked about how difficult that made it for the freelancers, I suppose. You're looking at those teams to really make the race, and they couldn't Quickstep with a couple of riders there. EF were really well represented there, and Bora Hansgrohe, and really it was up to those teams. We saw Nielsen Paulus kind of get away on a descent, and then press on, and it was Max Schachmann, who was away yesterday as well, bridged across to him, and that was well, we'll hear from Tom Southam, the sports director at EF. That was a little bit of a tricky situation for them, because Schachmann was clearly the stronger rider there. Their strongest man was Danny Martinez, and they had this question or problem of how to get Martinez up there. The problem was solved by Paulus actually being dropped by Schachmann, and that opened it up for Martinez to bridge across, which he did with Kamna. And coming into the finish, which we were all watching, as you say, Lionel, it was a really steep, murderous climb, and it was funny because Martinez, who's out of the GC picture, it was like he was riding for GC. He seemed to be only focused on, you know, grinding away. He didn't seem to be really paying a lot of attention to the riders he was with. Now, they dropped Schachmann.
It was like a time trial. It was like he was going to ride the final bit as fast as he possibly could without paying attention to what was going on around him.
I mean, he was just obviously that much better, I suppose. But Kamna jumped, and he didn't. He was looking the other way, and we were, oh my God, he's blown it.
Yeah.
But there was enough, because the road was so steep, there was enough time for him to come back.
Yeah, I think he knew, and he said it actually after the stage, he knew he was the strongest of the three. He'd seen it, he felt it, and he knew that the only way, if he had tried to play it clever or, you know, cunning and waiting for them and playing cat and mouth, he probably would have lost it. And he knew he was simply the stronger guy. And so he just carried on. You know, he went at his own pace, and the others couldn't follow. It was a great, great teamwork to do by EF Pro Cycling. We all have a soft spot for that team, and sometimes you have really bad luck, sometimes really good luck. But today, really, I mean, it was timed perfectly with Nielsen Paris, you know, attacking early. You Cartier was there, you know, to help around if needed.
Well, he did a great job, didn't he, getting exactly. Martinez into
it. It was obvious that, you know, they were setting up Martinez for the finish. Great. I mean, it's nice, because we've seen with Sunweb yesterday with Hershey's win, today with EF Pro Cycling, and even with Bora Hansgrohe, even if they've lost it. But I mean, there are great team tactics, you know, around you know, being played there, and the lack of domination by a team like Ineos in the past, and the fact that Jumbo-Visma are playing it in a more relaxed way, I think, than Ineos used to, you know, leave space for teams to maneuver a little bit, and I think that's exciting. That's very interesting to see. Bora, we'll go back to EF in a second, because they won it today. Bora seems to have lots of options now, that obviously today they gave up on the idea of all for Sagan, and they have so many options. Schachmann is getting back in shape, that they're in for. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a Bora stage win in the third week.
Well, I think the fact that Buchmann is out of the picture gives Kemner and Schachmann more of a free rein, rather than, I mean, Sagan was not going to do anything on a day like today, I don't think, was he? Unless he got in that break right off the bat. But just on EF, you mentioned, I mean, they really did they really did work very well together, not just once or twice, but, you know, three times. There was a period where Hugh Carthy was doing a lot of work to make sure that, you know, they had the three riders in that group. And well, we know that numerical advantage in a situation like that gives you so much more, so many more options to play with. And Richard, you said about Powless, you know, the problem being that maybe Powless wasn't the strongest, you know, wasn't stronger than Martinez, clearly wasn't, but what a fantastic position to be in, to know that you've got somebody up there, you can almost play leapfrog to get your preferred guy up there. Much better that position than being in one where you've got no one up the road and it's just all on the shoulders of one rider. I mean, Bora were in the same position as well with Kamna and Schachmann. It just didn't quite work out for them.
No, but as I said last night, one of the really fascinating things about the sport, I think, is that there aren't any teams here who are just here to get in meaningless breaks. They're all kind of here with serious objectives, and I think that's quite a big change. And it means that stages like today's are opportunities for everybody to do something. And we see the racing is just so full on right from the start, you know. And there's nothing controlled about it at all. I think there's got a scooter race going down the tram lines here. But I find it so interesting because that race kind of happens, it's almost separate to the GC race, but it has an impact on that. And it had an impact on the way that Jumbo-Visma had to ride and how hard they had to ride today.
Even teams like B&B Hotel, Vital Concept, at the beginning of the Tour de France, we would have thought, well, they're going to go in a breakaway just to show the jersey. Well, they do more than that. You know, Pierre, as I said before, Pierre Rolland was again up there. They're really, I mean, teams are really going for stage wins, even the smaller teams, which is interesting and exciting. About EF Pro Cycling, I'm always amazed, by the way, by Rigaud Uran, because, I mean, he's a kind of rider that every time we kind of, you know, we tend to look down on him a little bit because he's never kind of attacking, but he's so consistent. And now look at the GC standings. Without any flash or exuberant riding or anything, he's up there, and I don't think he will be dropped in the Alps or dropped at any stage.
I was told by a EF Pro Cycling staff member this morning, Matt Rabin, that Rigoberto Urán's performance here is the story of the tour, given the
top five finish is probable.
Interestingly, I was talking to Charlie Wagelius, Tom Sutherland, Matt Rabin this morning at the start, and they were asking me who I thought would win today, and I forgot to ask them who they thought would win today.
Yeah, they would have said Danny Martinez. I think.
Well have done.
Just on that point about the breaks, you're absolutely right, Richard. There hasn't been a single soft break in this tour. The only day there could have been a soft break, there was no break at all. And that is a very different Tour de France to, you know, I've often mocked the break going up the road with one Wanty Group Gobert rider and one Cofidis rider or something, and you kind of, you know what you're in for. This tour has not been like that.
Maybe
at all.
Maybe Jérôme Cousin, you know.
Every stage has seen a proper race and a great race, almost like a one day. Every day has almost been like a one day race. Shall we hear from EF Pro Cycling?
Yeah, of course.
Let's hear a little bit from our audio diarist Tom Sutherland, and a guy who's been really visible and ridden really well at this Tour de France, Nielsen Paulus. Spoke to him quite a lot the Vuelta last year when he was riding for Jumbo-Visma. He's moved and obviously has a lot more freedom there. But another reason for speaking to him was a story that caught our eye a couple of days ago in Velo News by James Rea. He's one of the first, I think we think the second Native American to ride the Tour de France after Darwin Atapuma, the Colombian rider. And that was something I wanted to speak to him about as well. So here was Nielsen Paulus at the start of the stage yesterday.
Spoke to you a lot at the Vuelta last year, but you seem to have come on a lot since then. Is that what it feels like for you?
Yeah, a bit. I think that my role has been slightly different than it was in the Vuelta last year. I think in the Vuelta it was a lot of riding on the front and just sitting in and conserving energy. And when I couldn't do something for Primoz, then we had to let go. But that was mainly because he was already in a position where we had to defend. So this year there's a bit more freedom for the guys supporting Rigo to either chase after Team GC or maybe chase after a result for the team, while Rigo can benefit off the work of other teams.
Yeah, we've seen you on the attack, obviously, and go pretty close. I mean, you look at your old teammates sometimes and see the job that they're doing here and, you know, feel glad that you made the move that you did?
Oh, I mean, I'm super happy being at IEF for sure. I think that, I mean, I'm able to find satisfaction if I were riding on the front or chasing after a stage win myself. So at the end of the day, as long as I'm riding my bike and doing what the team is asking me to do, then I'll be a happy guy. But yeah, it's also just, it is quite nice sometimes when you can feel that competitive fire again and chase after a stage win. And I think physically the strongest guy did win in the past couple days in the breakaways, but hopefully there'll be another chance soon enough.
Yeah, are there other stages that you have, you know, looked at fancy having a go again?
It's too hard to plan like from far out like that because we don't know what's happening with the GC or Team GC. So really, and even in the past days in the breakaways, I hadn't planned on going into the breakaway until about an hour before the start because it just sort of fit in line with the team plan and team director just gave me the go-ahead. So yeah, really just can't really plan these things from too far out. I think you can try to plan moves on GC from far out, but in terms of breakaways and leaving your GC rider behind, that has to come from up top, and yeah, only when your director thinks it's okay and safe.
Fascinating story in Velo News by James Rea about your status as the first Native American to ride in the Tour. When did you become aware of that?
I don't know, I guess just like a few days before the Tour, just looking around, and I know Darwin Adepuma was a Native from, I think, Colombia, but from America, from the United States, I would be the first Native American. So yeah, it feels quite special to be a trailblazer in that end, and hopefully I can just be a good role model for those watching.
Is that sort of family heritage and history important to you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was definitely an incredible like experience growing up with that level of connection to the country and the people and like my grandparents and just all the experiences that we had growing up and just them being such an encouraging factor to me and just like completely self-made people. And it's they taught, my grandparents taught me a lot about just taking your time with things and working hard for them and not really expecting a handout for anything, but just giving everything you can to your goal and hopefully being able to one day achieve it. And yeah, I mean, I guess I'm here for what my dream was, so hopefully I can inspire other kids that it's possible to get to this level even if it's terrible odds.
Yeah, it'll be a great day today. Out behind the break, got three in there to start with, which is no small feat at the moment. I mean, everybody wanted to be in that break, and it was very hard to get into. It was a long time before it really went. I think we did 46 Ks in the first hour with huge climbing. We could see the guys were good, Hugh and Danny, and Nielsen's been really, really solid at getting those moves. So once they'd gone it, I mean, it's much to think about tactically, especially because the finish was so hard. So we kind of let it play out. and without, you know, there being too much focus on us with three guys in there. And then Nielsen sort of chipped off. And then Shackman came across, which was sort of the beginning of a bit of a tight spot for us, really, because Shackman obviously had better legs than Nielsen and got rid of him on before the real final climb started. And so then when Danny was having to come across with, he just had Cameron in the wheel basically the whole time. But I think when we got to 5K to go, the base of the last climb, he'd been pulling to 6Ks with Cameron in the wheel, and Cameron tried to attack. And basically, Danny closed them so easily from there. I kind of said to the mechanic, it's a done deal, like he's going to win because he just had the best legs, and that's what counted on the finish line today. So, yeah, it was pretty cool. Great effort by all the guys. Back into the lead of the team's class, so that should make things a bit interesting over the next few days. Yeah, a good one.
Shoot. Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode is sponsored by the next generation Watt bike, Atom. Let's hear from another cyclist whose training has been revolutionised by riding a Watt bike.
Yeah, today we're going to hear from Steve Cooper, who, like Chris Scott, who we heard from earlier in the tour, has used the Watt bike to recuperate, in Steve's case, from a hip resurfacing operation.
I guess going back to, I think, 2018, I had a game of football and I felt something going in my hip. Consequently, attended the doctors. I got referred to a specialist who administered the news saying, you need a hip replacement. I said, what? I'm like 41 years old. So it came as a little bit of a shock. And then it was a case of finding the right surgeon. I booked myself in end of December 2019. So once the new one was booked in, it was just the case of having that date marked in the calendar and thinking, how do I recover? Having the Watt bike in the background looking at me before the operation, I thought, right then, as soon as I can get back on, I will. And I had a little bit of a training plan. I talked it through with the surgeon and he said, yeah, one of the best things you can do is getting on a bike and getting that movement back into the hip and strengthening it again. So that's the route that I went down. So the Watt bike was a little bit of a saviour, although it was a mentally difficult thing to get back on it and get going again. 3 weeks post-operation, I went on a little bit tentatively. I didn't clip in, but I got on with my trainers on and I thought, right, I've got to give this a go. It was a case of, right, I want to conquer you. I actually had a vasectomy as well at the end of February, so it was a case of, right, get myself back up to slight fitness, slight improvements. And then I was in end of February for the vasectomy. I didn't really want to sit on a bike for a couple of weeks. So I'd say end of March till now, I've noticed real improvements in my cycling, more so than ever before. But because I've got quite a lot of determination, I don't like to be beaten. And I think, right, okay, how can I improve here? And the Watt bike has generally really helped me.
Richard, when you had your hip replaced a few years ago, how soon were you back in action?
You're walking immediately, walking on the night of the operation. And then it's, you know, as much movement as you can tolerate, really. The rehab's about 6 weeks. I can't remember how long it took me to get back on a bike, but if I'd had a Watt bike or a stationary bike available, I think I would have been on that pretty quickly. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have an operation like this, one of the things that's often happened is that you've lost a lot of strength in that leg. And so one of the really interesting things for me about the Watt bike last year was the pedaling effectiveness score again and the balance between the right and the left leg, just to see how much work I still had to do, because the rehab does go on for a long, long time, years often, in order to just get the balance right between the right and left legs again.
Well, I think Steve's story just shows how versatile the Watt bike can be and how helpful it can be, not just for improving as a cyclist, but in his case, for recuperating from an operation as well. So the Watt bike Atom is available now from £90 per month. And if you'd like to find out more, go to wattbike.com, WATTBIKE.com.
A little bit of housekeeping before we turn our attention to the GC battle. On Monday, we'll do our second press conference. Send in your questions, please. Email. Audio files are preferred, so we can hear your voice. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. Send us in your audio files with any questions that you like at all. The second batch of Stacey Snyder's cups and mugs to benefit the Joyriders in London and Pichun in Toulouse will go on sale at some point next week. We'll keep you posted about when, but she's working on them just now. She's also working on a one-off cup, a Pedaleur de Charme cup. We didn't come with Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts this year because we weren't really sure what the situation would be, how easy it would be to get things to riders.
Well, impossible, really, in a way. Yeah, I mean, impossible. We'd have to hand them over with tongs and some washing powder.
2 meter long tongs. So we didn't do Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts this year. Hopefully we'll resume with those next year or the year after. But Stacey's very kindly offered to make a Pedaleur de Charme mug. So send us in your nominations for a Pedaleur de Charme. That'll be a Pedaleur de Charme for the whole tour. So we want a really special one, I think. She's done a one-off design. It looks fantastic. And I'm sure the recipient will be very happy indeed to receive a Pedaleur de Charme mug.
Before we go on to the GC battle, Rich, Danny Martinez, his career progression in terms of his World Tour wins is, it's the story of French stage racing, really, because last year his first World Tour race win was a stage of Paris-Nice, mm-hmm, in 2019.
The Tourini Pass
on the Turini, of course, yeah. This year, he won the overall in the Critérium du Dauphiné, as we mentioned, and now, of course, a Tour de France stage win. And it's the first Tour de France stage win for that team organisation since Rigoberto Urán in the Alps in 2017. And, well, Urán will probably be feeling pretty happy tonight because he was really on the coattails of the Slovenian pair, Roglic and Pogacar. And just to make the point that the overall at the moment, the top six, the first two are Slovenian and the next four are Colombian. I mean, it's extraordinary to see that, really. Bernal, Urán, Quintana and Lopez lining up behind Roglic and Pogacar.
Adam Yates in the non-Colombian or
that's
Slovenian
right. I was about to say that. Interesting to see Adam Yates still up there when we kind of ruled him out of contention forever.
It's funny to see him hanging on as long as possible when his goal apparently is to go for stage wins. But I guess when you're in the top 10 and he's moved up a place today, up to 7th overall, that's a hard thing to let go. For the fantasy, but the chance of winning a stage. But it's hard to win a stage, as we see every day. Whereas if you're in the top 10, you can hold on to that. That's a great result.
Mm. Yeah, he obviously has the legs to stay not with the very top riders, but the top 10 riders of the climbs. Why should he decide to suddenly lose 15 minutes to win a stage? It would seem a little bit dumb at this stage.
So today, listen, we saw Jumbo-Visma really take control of the stage quite early on and do quite a lot to just keep that break pegged at 5-6 minutes or so. And there were questions being asked about whether they were doing quite a lot, because there have been doubts about the form of George Bennett, Sepp Kuss. Robert Hessink seems very reliable and dependable. Tom Dumoulin also, he's there some days, not other days. And so there was this kind of question about whether they were taking on too much, cause given that there's still quite a long way to Paris. Later on the stage, we saw the Ineos Grenadiers really take it on as well and ride very aggressively in the kind of closing stages of the race, as if they were setting up Bernal to do something. And in the end, once again, the man that lit the bonfire was Tadej Pogacar. He has been the most aggressive rider in the top 10. His reward for that is to move up to second overall, but he was really swinging in the final few hundred metres. It was a very, very hard climb. And Roglic, I thought, looked very, very strong indeed today. He showed no signs of weakness at all. There's still a long way to go. And Bernal, he cracked a bit today. He lost a bit of time. He's third overall, but he's at 59 seconds. And coming out of the third weekend last year with a week to go, he was 2 minutes down. So he's closer now than he was at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I had a chat with Dave Brailsford this morning, a socially distanced chat, and he conceded that Bernal needs to be ahead of... why are you laughing?
I just love the qualification of that.
Well, I feel it's important, really. I mean, we're not puncturing the bubble, are we? And we should probably make clear that we're not puncturing the bubble.
I assume that you
spoke to him two meters away.
I was 2 meters away. I couldn't really hear what he said.
Meter and a half, I think. Meter and a half is the rule.
Meter and a half. I was 2 meters away.
I'll take my tape measure to the start tomorrow.
Safe. I couldn't really hear what you're saying, so this is just made up. No, he had his mask on. I had my mask on. I mean, absolutely hopeless.
I'm going to paint the scene a little bit more.
But he did concede that Bernal has to be ahead of Roglic going into the time trial in La Planche des Belles-Filles. And we're always slightly reluctant to look all the way to the end of the tour because there is so much racing to be done before then. But today was not a Bernal day at all. I'm just surprised that Roglic has opened up such a gap. I mean, it's 59 seconds now. The key thing about this tour is that it doesn't go above 2,000 metres very often at all. In fact, the only time it does, I think, is the stage to Méribel, where it goes over the Madeleine, which is 2,000 metres, and the finish itself at Méribel is 2,300 metres. That's getting towards the terrain where Bernal will be a little bit more comfortable, but that's not to write off Roglic. I mean, Roglic can operate at high altitudes as well. He's won stages that have gone very high before. But the,
I'm sure he's won ski jumps at that sort of altitude as well.
Yeah, he always, they always seem to finish down the bottom though, don't they? but the thing is that Bernal didn't react when Pogacar went, and Roglic did, and you know that tells us something, doesn't it? We're no longer in the opening sort of, you know, thrust of the GC battle. We're getting into the towards the thick of it now, and Sunday stage two, the Grand Colombier will tell us a little bit more. But I think, you know, Roglic probably does still need to turn the screw a bit more. But if you said now they go to La Planche de Belfie, the time trial, and Roglic is 59 seconds ahead of Bernal, you would say, well, fairly comfortable. I think the tour would be done. The real tricky one is 44 seconds over Pogacar enough?
I mean, it's the pacing of Roglic since the beginning of the tour has been perfect. I mean, we've said in the first week that he was kind of holding back. He was holding back. He seems to be holding back a little bit. But I mean, today asked Pogacar if he was holding back. I mean, in the last climb, really, Roglic seemed even stronger than Pogacar.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it is so far in this tour, it's absolutely unquestionable that Roglic is the stronger guy. It takes 20 seconds by 20 seconds and you know, kind of making a bigger gap with every stage. I'm sure he'll get some other guys out of the GC on the Grand Colombier. And probably, as you said, the stage to Meribel is really the last trump in Bernal's sleeve, you know, to try and upstage and kind of overturn the situation. So far, Roglic is just riding the kind of, you know what he reminds me in terms of the strategy and the tactics and the way he's riding, by taking little bits here and there and riding comfortably, is the way Miguel Indurain was riding his tours.
Well, he's doing it in a very unfussy, unflashy way, isn't he? I mean, he just looked comfortable and fast. Yeah, Pogacar in that last 800 meters, last kilometer, you know, the first time in this tour it looked like the helmet strap was a bit too tight on him,
and
he was gurning a bit. But I mean, he's in the white jersey now. He's leapt above Bernal. It's now a Slovenian 1-2, and you know, we have this impression that when Pogacar goes, Roglic reacts, and now that they are direct kind of head-to-head rivals, it'll be really interesting to see what happens on Sunday.
Roglic always in quite a low gear. He always looks like he's got another gear that he can choose. But we were talking last night that it has looked as if Roglic has been very conscious of the fact that it's a three-week race. And in the past, well, the Giro last year, you know, his form has dipped. And, you know, it has looked as if he has been holding back a bit. And, you know, as we go get closer to the end, his confidence will grow, I think, and he'll be less bothered about that. And I think, yeah, today was the most impressive day, I think, from Roglic. And I mean, the whole Slovenian story is absolutely fascinating. There's another Slovenian in the race who's been running very, very well, Luka Mezgic, who rides for Michelin Scott. You spoke to him at the start yesterday, Francois. Let's hear a little bit from Luka Mezgic.
Hi, Luka. I was wondering how it feels for you to have all these firsts these days about Slovenian cycling. I mean, you seem to become one of the leading nations in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, it feels good. Last few years, when Roglic started winning and Pogacar coming in, it's like maybe a lot more respect in the peloton as well for Slovenians. But yeah, it's good to see all those countrymen to have such success.
Why do you think it happens now that you know, you have a generation of riders doing better than ever?
I reckon it's just a coincidence. Like every time on 20, 30, 50 years, there's a good guy born who knows how to do cycling. And now it was Roglic coming from ski jumping, and also Pogacar coming actually from all the junior classes on.
You're a different rider than they are. You're a sprinter. Well, and you've been doing all right since the start of the tour. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm searching for my chances in the sprints. It's hard to be there alone, no lead-out train and stuff, but I'm trying my best, and yeah, I fight on.
Top 10 placings almost at every bunch sprint.
Yeah, I mean, it's just about the position. Like, if you see these sprints here, it's all very equal, and you just need a lot of luck to have gap opening in the end and that you don't have to break.
You think there might be an opening for you?
I really hope so.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast, as they have done since 2016.
Did you take a gel with you on your ride up towards Puy de Dôme?
I took a gel. I didn't use it, actually. I didn't need it today.
In the descent?
Not in the descent either. It was a 27-kilometre ride. A lot of climbing. Basically, half of it climbing and half of it descending.
You mean you didn't descend at all? You just kept climbing? And
No, I did. It wasn't a line. It wasn't a reverse Lionel Burney ride. It wasn't a pudding-powered downhill ride. It was an uphill and then a downhill. But I think you're going for a bike ride in the morning, Lionel.
I will do, yeah.
May join you, actually.
I'm going to try and find some flatter roads, I think.
Well, yeah, I would recommend that, because it wasn't a lot of fun, actually.
It's a surprisingly big city. I mean, I don't really want to be riding for sort of half an hour getting out of town, but I think I've found a way to get out of town quickly onto some flattish roads and then do a little loop round on quiet roads and get back.
The Michelin man, he could go down more quickly than you do.
I'd be mistaken for the Michelin man. hey, wow. I haven't done the Science of Sport code, have I? Scienceofsport.com. If you want 25% off, SISCP25 at scienceofsport.com. Sorry, Francois, stole your thunder there. Before the break, we heard from Luka Mezgic. You were going to just say something about that?
I was just imagining, I mean, there won't be many sprints finishes left, but can you imagine Mezgic, you know, winning one of the few sprints left? I mean, you would have had three stage wins by three different Slovenians in three, you know, different ranges. It would be absolutely amazing. I'm not saying he will, but I mean, he had lots of, you know, top 10 finishes since the beginning of this tour. Well, looking forward to to see him, who knows, you know, get on the podium of stage, or maybe win one. You never know.
What about the best of the rest in the GC battle? Because when Roglic, well, Pogacar, Roglic went a bit clear, all eyes were on Bernal in the white jersey. He was 6-7 wheels back and the gaps were opening, and we saw Mikel Landa look good. Richie Port looked really good, didn't he? I mean, he's been good in this tour, but for the time loss in the crosswind stage, he would be higher up on the GC, wouldn't he? I mean, he's currently lying in ninth place at 206. But he'd be up there.
He'd be in the top sort of five. He'd be around fifth, sixth. He'd be breaking up the Colombians there.
He would.
Yeah.
Maybe a mention of Bauke Mollema at this stage. With 13th at the start of the... It was always being, you know, a very consistent rider in the Tour de France. We had also his chances in the Trek Segafredo team, and who crashed out of the race, apparently with a broken wrist today.
But Richie Port is riding the last Grand Tour, certainly the last Tour de France, as the team leader. Richard, you pointed this out when we were watching the stage. He will join Ineos Grenadiers next year and will settle back into a support role. And it feels a little bit like he's racing with a sort of joie de vivre and a
freedom
and
we can almost see it lifting off his shoulders. He's never seemed all that comfortable with that pressure to be a GC leader, and yet now in his last outing in that role, he's riding really, really well. And you know,
third best of the GC riders today. I mean, that's not to be discounted. Landa, I thought, also looked good. Miguel Angel Lopez, I think, will be, do his usual, come into his own in the final week, perhaps. Uran looked fine. And
story
then,
of the tour.
Well, as I am. Yes,
Quintana,
I think,
who who hit the deck as well with Bardet, came off less seriously, but probably a slightly disappointing day for Nairo Quintana today.
Yeah, he crashed twice. I mean, Quintana without his two crashes would also be our little conversation was nearly interrupted by a guy who came past and who said, well, we kind of elbowed. It's the new kind of gesture of the coronavirus crisis. You know who he was? Is the big boss of the tour, Jan Lemoyne.
Wow.
So yeah, well, I nearly.
I was concentrating on podcasting. I was concentrating on what Lionel was saying.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe we could have Jan Lemoyne on the podcast, discussing the tour. But I mean, he went anyway.
Next time.
Yeah,
bigger boss than Christian Prudhomme.
Oh yeah, he's above Christian Prudhomme. Oh. He's number two. You've got Mario Di Lamori. You've got Mario Di Lamori's son, and you've got Jan Lemoyne. He's the general director of the tour. Yeah, and obviously a friend of the podcast.
Well, he is now. Any other business from today, chaps? Before we move further east tomorrow to Lyon, and head back towards the Alps.
Oh yeah, there's one thing I wanted to say, a small bit of local information, and which will go well with our, I know lots of our listeners like the nicknames. Have you heard about the Flea of the Cantal? The first guy in the Tour de France who went up Pas de Perol in France was a guy called Louis Bergaud. And he did it twice. The tour went up Pas de Perol, but the race went on. There was no finish on Puy Marie, and this guy Louis Bergaud was leading the way because he's a local rider, and it was called La Puce du Cantal, the flea of the Cantal. So I wanted to mention this guy because he was kind of pioneer rider up Puy Marie, or at least part of Puy Marie, and he had a nice little nickname.
And there's also a little snippet of news about Lyon maybe not, maybe putting a bit of pressure on the Tour de France to be greener than it currently is.
That's the sort of the story the stories that's been going in the French press these days. There was an interview in the local Lyon newspaper, Lyon where we're going tomorrow, with the newly elected Lyon mayor, who is a green, an ecologist, it was played up a lot as usual on the internet and on social networks, like the headlines were Lyon is ruling out hosting the tour again, and the mayor apparently would have said that the tour was too sexist and polluting. But I read the interview in Le Progrès de Lyon, that's the name of the newspaper. It's much softer than that. The Lyon mayor said the Tour de France is great French institutions, great race. It would be better if they were a little bit less sexist, and it's about time they have a women's Tour de France, he said. And he said, well, and the carbon imprint is not very good, and they should improve that. I think that we can we can only agree with that. I mean, so, but it was played up like, oh, Lyon, kind of a canceling, as is the trend these days, the Tour de France. It was not really the case, but it got played up because we had the municipal elections in France only two months ago, and there was a kind of a green sweep of the big cities, and actually the municipality of Rennes in Brittany ruled out welcoming or hosting the Tour de France stage next year when the tour starts from Brittany. Green mayor for the same reasons, not enough room for women and pollution, and the mayor of Poitiers was also a woman, and they have a team in Poitiers, a women's team in Poitiers, said that the next time the tour would come to Poitiers, she was hoping that it would be for the women's tour. So there's a kind of trend, there, quite justifiable.
It's very interesting because that will apply more pressure.
Absolutely,
of course. ASO and the Tour de France.
Yeah.
It's coming from all angles, sponsors, towns, the lifeblood of the race is kind of putting pressure on the Tour de France. And speaking of women's racing, the Giro Rosa started today in Italy, the Women's Tour of Italy, and Lizzie Banks, who presents Service Course for us. She's keeping an audio diary for us again. She did last year and she won a stage, which made her diary fantastic. It would have been fantastic anyway, of course. But she's doing it again this year. Trek Segafredo actually won the team time trial there tonight. So it's off, up and running, and we'll get a report from Lizzie. We'll also have an episode of Service Course dropping any day soon, won't we?
We will, yeah. Just on that, Francois, I mean, I've been at the start of the year, before the coronavirus crisis was even something we'd heard about, I was working on something about the impact of the climate change on professional cycling, but also professional cycling's impact on the environment. Talked to lots of experts, people whose knowledge of these things far, far outweighs mine. And it is strange that, you know, because it was prompted by the wildfires in Australia, which impacted on the races in Australia at the start of the year. We're now seeing wildfires in the west of America as well, in California and elsewhere. And it was kind of like the existential crisis for an event like the Tour de France might be significant changes to the climate. And it's interesting that pressure is slowly being applied. I mean, some would say that the pressure's not being applied quickly enough, but I think we'll probably put together an episode of Kilometre Zero on this subject for next week, if possible. If not, then it will certainly air sometime after the Tour de France.
Absolutely, yes. I'm looking forward to hearing that, Lionel. You've been working on that for a long time. Let's wrap things up for tonight, shall we? We didn't even discuss Marc Soler and he was obviously very strong today, but just seemed to ride it wrong. Let's talk about Movistar another day, because they're having a little bit of a shocker.
Yeah, it's funny, because I every time I'm in the race, I call my friend José Luis Arrieta, and he must think I'm dead or something, because I haven't called him once yet. So I'll do tomorrow, just to reassure him, that we're in the
You're
race
alive
and I'm there.
And kicking.
Yeah, I'm alive
well,
and kicking.
Until then, thank you very much. The doyen. And you, Francois.
Of course. Yeah.